All right, Daniel 5 doesn't mean chapter 5. It means this is our fifth class in the book of Daniel. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the first page and a half. I wanted to clean it up because I didn't like the way it, as I read it this from last week's class, so I wanted to put that in there. We do want to talk about a couple of things, though, and that kind of falls down to the second point in the first page, which is Nebuchadnezzar's journey of faith. After that first dream, as Christians, what would we do after we saw Daniel interpret that dream? Would it enhance our faith? Would it make us completely devoted to God? And yet, Nebuchadnezzar sees Daniel's God as a revealer of secrets, but in the next chapter, what does he do? Okay, he builds an image and he says, if anyone in the whole country doesn't worship it, what's going to happen? Does that show much respect to the Lord? No. So then after the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego situation, he then says in the middle of the page there, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him, and they have frustrated the king's commandment and yielded their body that they should not serve or worship any god except their own. But he will go on. In the next chapter, who does he call first when he has the dream? He calls the enchanters and the servants of his God. So his journey is slow. It's developing, and it's fascinating because, as I'll point out in the as we start the next chapter, we have a very interesting situation here with God working with a non-Jew. We read Romans chapter 1, and sometimes we think, well, when God gave them up, what did he do? He just wrote them off. He doesn't work with them at all. But what do we learn from Naaman? What do we learn from that widow? Jesus said there were many widows and lepers in the time of Elijah, but God only sent him to which two? To the Gentiles. Right. And so this journey here, God gives him a dream. Does God have any responsibility to give him that dream? Why does God send this dream to Nebuchadnezzar? Couldn't he have delivered it to Daniel and Daniel just given the information? So is God a respecter of persons? If God is doing this for Nebuchadnezzar, who else would he be doing it for? And what did Peter say in chapter 10? God is no respecter of persons, but in every nation, those who fear him. And so we are faced with a situation where did God call Abraham out of that world because of his faith? What's he going to do with other people who are like Abraham? Virgil?
Yeah, you're raising a good point. There's probably, we'd like to know a whole lot more of what took place.
Yeah, we would. I sure would.
but there is plenty of evidence that whoever respects God, God will turn to them and help them in some way, shape, or form. That's not a question. That's a positive statement there.
Right.
He will. And we just know that he has done that because we see some of the overflow of it. What was it? Even Melchizedek was his background,
right,
in history. And here he was, he's a high priest.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that has happened. But it would be great if we had some more information.
Oh, yeah. No, it sure would. But this is a huge glimpse into how God works. Mm-hmm. And what I find fascinating about it is, could Pharaoh have come to the same conclusion if he wanted to?
Yeah.
See, so God is constantly working. As you go through the history of God's people, he's not just exclusively working with them. Yes, he gave up the Gentiles. I mean, he's no longer working with them on a day-to-day basis. But if he finds someone, and let's go ahead and turn over to the next page, and let's talk a little bit about this under the chapter 4. I put the completion of Nebuchadnezzar's journey, because by the end of this chapter, he is completely convinced that God is the only God and that he is going to be serving him and is in the position that he has only because of that. So you look at those first three verses, and again, I just wanted to emphasize the fact that God is not partial. So if we see something, like the Ethiopian eunuch, was God partial to him? Is that the only time that's ever happened in the history of the world? God sees a sinner, and that sinner needs to hear the gospel, and there's nobody around, so he gets somebody there to teach him. Does that not happen today? Of course it happens today. Because God wants all men to be saved and come to the knowledge of the truth. And so this situation is giving us a little bit of a heads up. There's a passage in Romans that is very difficult, and I haven't really come to a full conclusion on it, but it talks about those who were without law doing by nature the things of the law. And so as God is scanning the earth, does he see people like that? And does he want to bring them closer to him? You say, well, how does he do it? Well, I don't know how he does it. I just know that this gives me a better conception of the love, the mercy, and the compassion of God. You know, you think about the Middle Ages when... could anybody read in the Middle Ages?
No.
No. Did anybody have access to a Bible?
No.
No. If they were going to know anything about God, then how were they going to learn it? Well, they were going to have to learn it from the priests. There wasn't anything else they could do. Now, what's going to happen to all those people? You say, well, God's just going to throw them all away. Well, does that strike you as being a very fair thing that you happen to? What if you had been born during that time and you had the same attitudes you have now, but there wasn't any way to do anything with it? So these kind of events help, at least for me. I mean, when I have to answer somebody's question about how does God deal with these things, I would take them to Nebuchadnezzar and I would take them to Naaman and I would say, I don't have a clue how God does this, but he's a merciful, loving God and he will do whatever is necessary to be fair and just and honorable and loving to all people. So that's what I find interesting here. And of course, the next section, and again, I'm not going to read it all because I want to focus primarily on the dream this evening, but God's testing the hearts. He's testing the hearts of all men. He watches. You remember when Jesus said, before Philip came to you, I saw you under the fig tree?
Nathanael.
Okay, yeah, Nathanael. And what does Nathanael say at that point? My Lord, you are the King of Israel. You are everything that they say. But the point is, he saw the test. He saw the results of the test. And then he reminds Nathanael, I saw this test and I saw the results of it, so I know what kind of man you are. Well, is that the only time that ever happened? No, it's always happening. Brian?
Yeah, and I think didn't he also tell him there's nothing false in this man? So he knew him. He knew his character.
Yeah.
To your point, like God, well, Jesus did too. He said there's nothing false in this man. He knew his heart.
And then that passage in Acts where Paul is in Corinth, and Corinth is the what of the Roman Empire? The armpit of the Roman Empire, and he's there, and he's in much fear and trembling, he says, and Jesus appears to him and says, what? I have many people in this city. Well, how does the Lord know that? They haven't been converted yet. If they were, Paul would know it. So he knows. He knows who's going to obey the gospel. I mean, how does the psalmist say, all the days that I have, you already know. They haven't been lived yet. Carl?
The faithful always keep in mind that we don't come close to understanding the knowledge of God.
Right.
And by faith, we believe what we believe or what he has taught us. And it was not for us to know. Otherwise, he's told us.
Right.
The secret things belong to him.
Right.
So it's my obligation to inquire, but it's not my in my purview to question.
Yes. And that's what I'm trying to get across is that we can be comfortable and assured that God knows what he's doing and that God loves these people and that there's no unfairness with God and there's no partiality with God. I mean, I look at all these people in China and I think, how are they gonna ever hear the gospel? But what am I limiting when I think like that? Yeah, see, God knows who they are, and he can work it out, and there's churches there. George?
Well, we need to keep in mind that from day one, God told mankind what to do, and when we consider even after the flood, Noah and his family supposedly knew enough to obey God, but then man went away from God, and even the Old Testament, we see that there were some prophets that went to the other people besides the Israelites. So God's not totally forgotten mankind. Mankind's forgotten God.
Right. Charles?
Yeah, also along the same lines, you know, a lot of times we think, you know, God is don't know what's going on in our lives or whatever. But, you know, he tells us also, says, my ways are not your ways, neither are my thoughts your thoughts. In other words, we might write somebody off in some way. But, you know, God can create situations where honest teachers or whatever can get together with somebody who is really, really sincere and honest about learning something from his word and then obeying it also.
Right. So. Yeah. And that's what I'm trying to bring out, because why doesn't God change everyone into an animal until they acknowledge that God rules in the kingdom of men? And wouldn't that be fair? Or wouldn't you rather be turned into an animal and learn that God rules than be sent to hell after you die? Well, why doesn't he? Well, because we see with Pharaoh. Does it work with everybody? Why didn't Jesus appear to everyone? Why did he appear to Paul? Why didn't he appear to all the Jews? Well, what did he know? What did he tell? What did Abraham tell that rich man when the rich man said, send him back? Well, they said they had Moses the prophet, but he said, if the Lord had appeared to them, would they have figured out a way to ignore it? So God is no respecter of persons, and I think most of us who were not raised in the church, we can pinpoint certain points in our life where God intervened, and then, like I say, Nebuchadnezzar had a journey. We all had a journey. A journey from unbelief, or a journey from knowledge of God, but not a perfect knowledge of God, and then he brings us where we need to be. And so this is not an act of a special act. It is simply God working with a man to help us understand his care and concern even for these people, even for Nebuchadnezzar, who destroyed his temple and killed most of his people. Virgil?
Yeah, this is an area where it's difficult. We have a tendency to I don't want to use the term second-guess God, but they can use the term, it's okay. We're limited to what we know. And that's what we have to say, is what we know.
Right.
And we can't vary from that. But there's an area that we don't know. And once a man passes from this life, that's an area that we don't know.
Right.
And somebody coined the term, well, that's, if we try to determine that, we're whittling on God's end of the stick.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I don't want to be guilty of that, nor does anybody. But we have a responsibility to teach what we know.
Right.
What the scriptures teach us. And sometimes it's a very difficult thing to work with people, to get them to understand what the scriptures say about different things.
Right. No, and that's exactly right. And again, the purpose here is not to alleviate our responsibility. We have responsibility to teach the gospel to every person we know, because we're going to be the final step in some people. And do they have to hear the gospel in order to be saved? Well, yeah, and who's going to give that to them? Well, it's going to be the Philip to the Ethiopian eunuch. And so we're all working in there, but I just want us to realize that God's working behind the scenes. And that every person he brings to us, every person that crosses our path, could God have brought them for the very purpose of our completing their journey? And so when we see events like this, we see God working behind the scenes, and we see God not only working with Nebuchadnezzar, but when Nebuchadnezzar sends that letter out, you see at the bottom of page 2, it's to all peoples, nations, languages that dwell in all the earth. So it wasn't just for Nebuchadnezzar. Who else heard about it? Everybody heard about it. So this was a wake-up call. On a large scale, kind of like, again, Naaman with the Syrians. His situation must have been talked about. He was a man of valor. Johnny? Did you hand up? Yeah, go ahead.
On me?
Yeah, aren't you Johnny? I'm sorry, I didn't say it loud enough. What's up?
I don't know, there's been times in my life that I didn't understand that God had interfered in my life. Even before I was a member of the Lord's church, things happened in my life that I believe he interfered for me. I don't know if I can prove it or not, but I understand that we do not know these things.
Right.
And we're not meant to know these things.
Well, but if you obeyed the gospel, I think we know it. Because how do you obey the gospel without God bringing it to us? You remember Paul, when did Paul say he was actually chosen? From his mother's womb. So what was God doing with him all that time? He was preparing him for that role. George?
Well, we need to remember that God never forces anyone to obey. And also we need to keep in mind when we are wondering why things happen, that God expects mankind to search for him. And there's lots of things that have been done already for all mankind that help that. For instance, the availability of the Bible today is so available. And even almost 100 years ago, I know of situations where someone was simply given a Bible and they read the Bible themselves,
right,
and became a Christian.
Yeah.
Because of understanding what they read.
But one of the reasons I think this is so important is that we tend to overgeneralize. I mean, let's think about America right now. What do we think about America? What's next for us? Are we going to fall? We should fall, right? There's no hope left. Or we're just on the precipice. Well, how do we know that? Is God humbling people right now? This sexual thing is just, I'm just astounded by it. I'm watching it and I'm just thinking to myself, where's this going to go? And what's it going to do as far as humbling people and maybe bringing us back to a whole different way of looking at life? And this could be a tipping point in a lot of ways. We'll see what happens. In the political realm, it's still being resisted. But if this thing sweeps the country, it's going to change the moral outlook significantly and could lead to an opportunity for us. Robert?
Well, in general, man can't handle now what God has revealed. So we don't need to know anymore.
Well, that's true.
We can't handle what we got now.
That's true.
You think knowing more is going to help? No, knowing more is going to mean they're going to reject more.
Right. But what I'm trying to do is help us to see that there are some things in here that we need to be really careful, because we have no idea. How many people, what did Elijah say to God?
I'm in.
Yeah. What did God say?
You have no idea.
Many haven't bowed.
I still got 7,000. There's still 7,000 that you don't know anything about. So we just don't know. All right. Okay, so let's go ahead and jump into the dream. As I mentioned, he's still not really convinced. He starts at the bottom of page 2 with a letter. This is part of the letter he sent out. So the chapter actually starts with the results of the letter, the results of the dream, and then brings us back. So after the dream is fulfilled, he writes this letter. He talks about the fact that I saw a dream and I was afraid, and so I issued a command. Now, why does he do that? Why does he bring all these enchanters back in if he's really convinced that Daniel could give him the answer? What's that? Yeah, he's not fully convicted. And of course, when you bring a righteous man into your presence, what does he tend to make you feel like? I mean, that's why we're persecuted. Because when we're, I was reading in 2 Corinthians where Paul said, we are an odor of death to death to the unbeliever, and an odor of life to life to the Christian. You ever think about that? In other words, we're in their presence. The light comes, and what a lot of things we say and do has to make them feel. So, and that's our responsibility. We're supposed to do that, and that's what Daniel was doing. Daniel never pulled any punches with Nebuchadnezzar. And so Daniel here is not called. He's not called first. You'd think, well, after what happened with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, what happened with Daniel and the enchanters the first time, he'd be calling them first, but he doesn't. He's still calling in the soothsayers, and then you think to yourself, well, they heard the dream this time. Why don't they give him a false interpretation? Well, what do they know would happen if Daniel came in? See, so things have changed in the kingdom here, and Daniel and God are working in the kingdom, and things are happening. And it's interesting, this is the first time that Nebuchadnezzar calls him Daniel. And what does that signify? Well, you see that it's going to say here in a minute that I was giving you the name after my God, but now he's calling him Daniel, which means what? He's not looking at Daniel as a servant of his God anymore. he's looking at Daniel as a servant of God. I went ahead and put the definition again above the content of the dreams. Daniel either means God is my judge or the judge of God. And Belteshazzar either means the prince of Bel or Bel protect him or his life. So he's every time Daniel's called with a Babylonian name, what's the inference? Idolatry. Idolatry. He takes the names of these Jews, and every time they're called by the names in the Chaldean language, they are brought face to face with a blasphemy that is going to... I mean, how would you like it if somebody named you after the name of a god? And every time people called you, that's what the name... What would you want to do pretty quick?
Change it.
I'd get rid of this name. I don't like this name. Well, like I said, this is the first time he calls him by that. And as I say, the soothsayers and the magicians and the astrologers and the Chaldeans, they're afraid. They don't want to touch it. So Daniel comes in, and again, you see that at the very first line there on 4, 8, and 9. It says, Belteshazzar, according to the name of my God. In him is the spirit of the holy God. Now, what we see here is there's an equivalency, right? My God is the same as his God, except that his God can do things my God doesn't do, and my God can do things that his God can't do. So I'm still believing in my God. Well, that won't happen toward the end of this. That's going to completely change. So he calls him in, and he extols him for having the spirit of the holy God, and that no secret will trouble him. So I want to know the interpretation of the dream. And the contents of the dream are pretty basic. What does he see? He sees a big tree. And as he sees the big tree, it keeps growing. And it keeps growing until everyone in the earth, it can be seen to the ends of the earth, and all the beasts, and this isn't just animal farm animals, this is all the beasts that exist in the world are under this tree. The tree is growing, it's becoming stronger, it is full of fruit, it is full of beautiful leaves. It's just a beautiful, awesome tree. And then in the next section, and let's see, I'm going to have, Virgil, you want to read that for me? I'm just going to pick out some random people tonight. Chapter 4, verses 13 through 15, a little bit below the middle of page 3.
I'm looking for it.
That's okay. Begins, I hit you out of the blue, you can have all the time you want. Daniel 4, 13 through 15, page 3, about the fifth paragraph from the bottom.
I saw the visions in my head while on my bed, and there was a watcher, a holy one, coming down from heaven. He cried aloud and said thus, chop down the tree and cut off its branches, strip off its leaves and scatter its fruit. Let the beasts go out from under it and the birds from its branches. Nevertheless, leave the stump and roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze.
Okay. Now, we might think this is Babylon, but did Babylon fall when Nebuchadnezzar became an animal? No. That's what the band signified around the roots, around the stump of the tree, is that Babylon is not going to fall. So, and we see the comparison in the next verse where it talks about, it goes from it, the tree, to him, the individual. So this tree is not Babylon. This tree is Nebuchadnezzar. And of course, Nebuchadnezzar is the ruler over Babylon. But the point that God wants to make is, yeah, you're really great, and you're just like that the gold image in the first vision and the great tree in the second vision, but how'd you get there? See, you got there because I put you there. I'm the one who made Babylon. I raised it up. Remember what he told Habakkuk? I'm raising up right now a work that you wouldn't believe somebody told you. I'm raising up the Chaldeans, and they're going to become a great nation because God rules in the kingdoms of man, and that's what he needed at that time. And so, as I mentioned a moment ago, Nebuchadnezzar's responsibility was to go into Jerusalem and do what to all the people? Put them all to death. Remember Jeremiah? Such as are for death, such as are for famine, such as are for starvation. You're going, and Nebuchadnezzar is my instrument to do that. And what did he do to the temple? He broke it all down. So God used him And now God is warning him. Daniel sees this as a warning. He doesn't see this as something that's necessarily going to happen. This is a similar warning to the one we have. If we aren't faithful unto death, what's going to happen to us? We're not going to get the crown of life. And so he's warning him. You need to make some changes. And that's what Daniel's going to make a point. Now, we see in the next verse. Let's see. Charles, you want to read that for us? 4:13-18.
It says, in the tender grass of the field, let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let him graze with the beast of the grass on the earth. Let his heart be changed from that of a man. Let him be given the heart of a beast, and let seven times pass over him. This decision is by the decree of the watcher, and be sentenced by the word of the Holy One, in order that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men. Give it to whomever he will, and set over it the lowest of men. This dream I, King Nebuchadnezzar, have seen. Now you, Belteshazzar, declare it interpretation. Since all the wise men of my kingdom are not able to make known to me the interpretation, but you are able, for the Spirit of the Holy God is in you.
Okay. So you see in that very first verse, which is verse 13, that the tree is going to be cut down, the branches are going to be knocked off, the fruit's going to be scattered, the animals are going to go away from under it. But then it says, let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and then what? What happens to the pronoun?
Changes to him.
So, let him graze with the beasts of the earth. Now, some commentaries trying to figure out what natural illness would cause this to happen. Do you think there is a natural illness that would cause you to grow feathers and hands like claws and lose your mind and eat grass and be able to live for a long time? No, this is a supernatural event. This is not something that, in verse 16, let his heart be changed for a man. Well, if it was insanity, how would he ever figure out that God rules in the kingdoms of men and gives it to whomever he will? So his reasoning leaves, but there's got to be a portion of it that's still with him, watching over this. And then he hears in verse 17, and it'd be interesting to know who these watchers are, these holy individuals who are involved in this. When Daniel gets it, he just says Jehovah. I mean, he just says the Most High. He doesn't give us any further enlightenment on who these beings are. But we do know later on in the book of Daniel, we're going to learn about Michael, the archangel. We're going to learn about Gabriel. We're going to learn about them working in the affairs of men and struggling against the battles that are going on there. And so we learn a lot in Daniel that there's a lot going on. I mean, it's kind of like Ephesians 6. Our wrestling is not against flesh and blood, but what?
Principalities,
power, world rulers, spiritual hosts of wickedness. Who are they? I don't know who they are. Why does God tell me about it? So I can be afraid, so I can realize this isn't something you can win on your own. This isn't something, you're not just battling against your own desires. You're battling against beings who are basically out to get you. Charles?
Yes, when you asked me to read, did you say 4:13-15? Or did you say,
No. I you read exactly what I wanted you to read. No.
I thought I was at the wrong
You don't think I'm big enough to say, Charles, that's it. I don't want you going.
I just want to make sure.
No, I would never do that. All right. So, no, it was perfect. And so we have pretty much what's going to be involved in this. And of course, we can read. Can you read between the lines on a lot of this? Of course, we already know the interpretation, so it's kind of unfair. But a lot of it, just because of our knowledge of God, we would be able to comprehend. But I really like this statement in verse 17. The living may know. Is this just for Nebuchadnezzar? No, this is for the living. Are a lot of people going to be reading about this in the years to come? I mean, here we are, what, almost 2,000, 3,000, you know, some years later? We're still reading about it, and we're still drawing that application, that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men. So this wasn't just for Nebuchadnezzar, just like the events in Egypt, were not just for the Jewish people. They were for us as well. And so so Nebuchadnezzar is now confused. So now Daniel is going to explain the vision. And it starts out in the very bottom of the page, and I'm not going to have us read that. But when Daniel hears about this, is he happy?
He's troubled.
Yeah, he's troubled. Now, there's a decision we have to make there. I've gone one way. You can kind of wrestle with it. You think he didn't want to tell him because he was afraid or because he cared about it? Both?
I think he cared about
him. Okay. I think he cared about him. But then you run into the other thing. Yeah, but it's going to make him know that the Most High rules in the kings of men. So why wouldn't he just say, oh, this is great, king? No. What he does is interesting. And let's turn to the top of page 4 because there's something in here that I hadn't really noticed before. And I'm not going to worry too much. You know, we can deal with the interpretation later. What I want us to see is what is stated in the chapter 4, verse 27. Jeannie, you want to read that for us? Middle of page 4, under Nebuchadnezzar ignores Daniel's advice.
Therefore, O king, let my advice be acceptable to you. Break off your sins by being righteous, and your iniquities by showing mercy to the poor. Perhaps there may be a lengthening of your prosperity.
Okay, so what does Daniel say? You know, there's a reason for this dream, and you can avert it if what? All right, so are these the fruits of repentance? Sometimes we think, well, the only thing Nebuchadnezzar was to learn was that the Most High rules in the kings of men. Is that what Daniel says here? You just need to acknowledge that God rules in the kings of men. Does he want a confession or does he want more?
He wants more.
If God rules in the kingdoms of men and Daniel or Nebuchadnezzar is convinced of it, what should he do? Break off your sins and your iniquities by being righteous, by showing mercy to the poor. So this is the only way you can avoid this, king. You have to become a servant. You have to acknowledge God rules in the kingdoms of men, and you have to live the life worthy of that confession. And don't know whether the king tried for a while, but we see that Nebuchadnezzar, at the end of 12 months, let's see, let's pick somebody else here. Carl, you want to read that for us? Starts out, all this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar.
All this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of the 12 months, he was walking about the royal palace of Babylon. The king spoke, saying, is not this great Babylon that I have built for a royal dwelling by my mighty power and for the honor of my majesty? While the word was still in the king's mouth, a voice fell from heaven. King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom has departed from you, and they shall drive you from men, and your dwelling shall be with the beast of the field. They shall make you eat grass like oxen, and seven times shall pass over you, until you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he chooses.
Okay. So Nebuchadnezzar, does he break off his sins? Does he admit God rules in the kingdoms of men and gives it to whomever he pleases?
No.
No. So the preaching, did the dream succeed? No. Did the preaching succeed? Didn't touch him. So what had to happen? He had to go through the experience. And what a terrible experience it must have been. As I say, I don't think he was completely without understanding of what was going on, because what good would it be if he was without understanding of what was going on? Carl?
And we can keep in mind that this day and present time, the turmoil that's going on in the world and the governments around the world, that God is allowing it to happen. And he'll take care of it when it gets enough.
Right. No, and that's right.
It's all in his plan. So we can, as you mentioned, the Apostle Paul. Why did God let the Apostle Paul persecute all the Christians at that time? We don't know.
No, we don't know.
And we don't know why such ferocious rulers over governments and countries in the world today. But God allows it. And Christians should keep that in mind.
Right. Now, the interesting thing here, is this a judgment or is this an act of mercy on God's part?
Mercy.
See, you look at the outcome, and I couldn't help but think of Job. Because after Job lost everything, and he finally came to whatever realization God wanted him to come to, what does he do at the end of the book? He restores everything back to him. And what does he do for Nebuchadnezzar? It says everything was restored back to him, except now, so he didn't lose anything, right? He went through this whole process, and Job the same thing. He went through this whole process, and when it's all over, he gets twice as much as he had before. So it wasn't God's intent to punish him. It was God's intent. And of course, with Job, we know there's some other factors involved, and I think there are here too, because as I said, this letter went out into all of Babylon, into the entire empire. You think maybe it might have had an influence over some people out there? See, I don't see how it couldn't have. And anybody who was searching and realizing the futility of idolatry would have been very impressed by these events. And it wasn't the only event that had come out of there. The first dream had come out of there. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. That had gone throughout the entire Babylonian Empire. And now this is going to go out through the entire Babylonian Empire. And yet, we're going to learn in the next chapter, his son knew all of this, but what did it do for him?
Nothing.
It didn't help him at all. It helped Nebuchadnezzar, but it didn't help his son. Carl?
And we see the difference between Pharaoh and Nebuchadnezzar. Pharaoh never repented.
No, Pharaoh drowned in
and
the sea.
He was destroyed.
Right, right.
But yeah. Nebuchadnezzar repented and was restored.
And isn't that what Jesus said to Paul, Saul of Tarsus on the road? It's hard for you to kick against
the goads.
How well is he going to kick against this last goad? He's done kicking. He's been impaled. Brian?
Yeah, and it kind of reminds you of, you know, God knew his heart, knew if he was put in those circumstances, he would eventually see the light, so to speak. He'd repent. Kind of like Manasseh, you know, he had to be carried off into captivity, but he finally came to his senses and went back and did the right thing, restored the worship and all that.
Right.
So anyhow.
Yeah, no, that's right. Charles?
Yeah, also, I was just looking at that part right there where it says, the kingdom has departed from you. It kind of reminded me of Saul.
King Saul?
King Saul.
Yeah, he could have learned from his lesson,
exactly.
Too.
Exactly, yeah.
But he didn't. And that's the point. The same sunshine shines on butter and concrete, but what is the result? So the same love and mercy and strength of God's power shines into hardened hearts and softened hearts, and it continues to soften the good hearts, and for some reason, it continues to harden. And I think that's the point of the last sermon I preached before I left, is that God will send them a strong delusion. The further you kick against this and the harder your heart gets, the more deluded you become. And it's just God is not mocked. You're going to reap what you sow. And as Jesus pointed out, to whom much is given, much is expected. All right. So the last point here is that he even confesses the sin of pride. He even confesses at the verse 37 there. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, second to the last verse on page 4. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all of whose works are truth and his ways justice, and those who walk in pride he is able to put down. Now who's he talking about? This is a confession. And I think that what we see here is he did break off his sins. And he did learn from this experience. And again, as I point out in that last paragraph, one of the most amazing events we read about concerning God's dealing with the Gentiles after he gave them up. So don't think when he gave them up that means he's not still going to work with individuals, because as he finds these people, he's going to do that. And God gave this to Nebuchadnezzar, and by its public nature, he gave it to all the wise men in Babylon. And yet, again, we don't really know how many people it actually influenced, but after Babylon falls, are there still good people out there who are ready to serve God? Where did Cyrus get his information? This only happened, you know, maybe 20 years after this event, if that. But when Cyrus comes along, what's the first thing he says? We need to get the Jews back in Jerusalem, and we need to get them to build that temple, and we need to be able to have God worshipped again on earth. Where did he get that information? And you say, well, certainly this would have been a part of it. This wasn't done in a corner. And so, all right. Anything else? Okay. Won't be any additional from the previous class. Next week we'll be starting new. Okay, thank you.